You might not realize how much you rely on your office supplies until your highlighter goes dry, your stapler becomes jammed, or you lose the end of your Scotch tape. But in his new book, The Perfection of the Paperclip, Curious Tales of Invention, Accidental Genius, and Stationary Obsession, James Ward shows the beauty in these mundane objects and puts them into historical context. Mr. Ward is the co-founder of something called the Boring Conference, where he draws attention to the underappreciated things that enhance our lives. And I'm very pleased that he brings his knowledge of office supplies to today's Please Explain look at office supplies. James, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If anyone in our audience has a question about office supplies, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. And while you're at it, tweet us your pictures of your favorite office supplies. James, you're in the UK where office supplies are called stationery. In this country, the word stationery applies to paper products. What happened?
Well, I think the word stationery itself comes from the fact that a long time ago, people would sort of travel from town to town selling their wares, whether they were, you know, selling pots and pans or whatever. And as train stations became sort of more popular, more common, certain types of products were sold at train stations and would, instead of being sold by traveling salesmen, the salesmen became stationery and they started selling stationery.
And then in America, we just took the paper part of it and made that stationery?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, for in the UK, stationery can refer to not just paper products, but, you know, paper clips, staplers, the whole sort of, I guess, yeah, what you call office supplies.
And you
it's
found
a broader term here.
And you have found something called the Stationery Club. People get together and talk about paper clips?
Yeah, Stationery Club started as a hashtag on Twitter by a friend of mine, Ed Ross. And he'd use the hashtag whenever he wanted to talk about stationery or office supplies. But I kind of felt that Stationery Club sounded a bit better than that. It sounded like it should be a real club. So I sort of imagined it as being like a book club. With a book club, everyone, you know, you nominate a book and then everyone goes away and they read that book and then they get together and discuss the book. And I kind of thought that the same thing could be with Stationery Club. Someone would nominate a pen and then we all go off and use that pen for a couple of weeks and then get together and, you know, discuss that pen, whether it was if it smudged or if it was too scratchy. But that then perhaps was a bit too specific or too particular, and so instead it sort of broadened out into a more generalized get together where people would talk about their favorite items of stationery.
And you tell a lot of interesting stories about various items of what you call stationery, but the paperclip is in your title. Why did you choose that?
I think the paperclip is quite interesting because it's an item which is so familiar to all of us. We all know when someone says a paperclip, everyone knows exactly what you're meaning. This particular sort of double loop design. But despite its familiarity, no one actually knows who invented it. And so that, to me, that sort of represents the way that we've kind of taken these products for granted and we've not really sort of preserved or thought about their history. And so that's, I think that's why sort of the paperclip appeals to me.
A Norwegian patent clerk named Johan Valer filed a patent application for the clip in 1899, and he has been called the father of the paperclip, but he is not the inventor?
No, in terms of, well, there's a website called the Early Office Museum, and they put it rather brutally in that they said that his invention was neither first nor important, which is a bit of a crushing blow.
Well, that's not true. I couldn't live without paperclips.
Yeah, exactly. But the paperclip was around before Valer's patent. There's sort of evidence of it in trade literature and advertising materials that sort of date it back a couple of decades before he registered his patent. But what's actually, I mean, he did design a type of clip, but it's not the one that we think of, the gem, as it's known. That appears sort of decades before, but no one really knows who invented it. But
and how did it get that name?
It was just one of the early companies that sold it was called Gem Manufacturing, and I guess they had the better advertising people in that their name was able to stick.
Now, Valor was from Norway. Didn't the paperclip become an important political symbol in Norway during World War II?
Yes, it's got this sort of curious double history in Norway. It wasn't actually anything to do with the fact that Valor was Norwegian and was believed to have invented the paperclip. That idea only sort of really became popularized later. But during the years of Nazi occupation, Norwegians used to wear paperclips on their lapels as a sort of subtle sign of resistance, because it symbolized this idea that we're all bound together. And also, it's in terms of signs of resistance, it's very easy to deny. If a guard comes up to you and says, "Why have you got that paperclip on your lapel?" you can quite convincingly claim, you know, "Oh, I was just doing some paperwork earlier. I must have, as I was putting away some files, I must have just put it there, sort of as safekeeping, and then forgotten about it." But the people who knew what it meant knew what it meant.
There are a couple of other major figures in the development of paperclips: Matthew Schooley and Samuel B. Fay. Did they come up with other versions?
Yes. I mean, throughout history and even still to this day, people continue to try and refine the paperclip and make little adjustments. So there are lots of different varieties and different sort of subspecies within the world of the paperclip itself.
Well, why has the gem been the one that has been most common? Is it the most efficient?
I mean, people often talk about it as being this example of perfect design. I'm not so sure that I'd necessarily say that it was perfect, but it seems that it's kind of okay or on all levels. It sort of gets like 8 out of 10 in each different category because, I mean, some people have developed types of paperclip which have got a more pointy end, which means that then it slides onto the paper more easily. But the downside of that is then the pointy end can sort of tear or damage the paper. There are other versions with sort of a slight lip on the end. Mm-hmm. And again, that means it's easier to slide onto the paper, but it means that if you have a stack of papers, then those little lips mean that the stack becomes sort of bulkier than it would otherwise be. There are versions with little grooves along the clip itself, which means that it grips more effectively, but at the same time it's harder to remove. So with each sort of improvement that people have tried to make on the basic gem design, that comes with a cost and in some other aspect, whereas the gem just seems to sort of be just right on all of these different levels.
But each of them required the invention of a machine to make them. Can you describe the early machines that made paperclips?
Well, actually, the interesting thing about the paperclip is that the first time the gem form appears in patent literature is by a design by a guy called William Middlebrook, and his design is actually for the machine that made the clip rather than the clip itself. So obviously the clip must have existed before. I mean, it's sort of a slight chicken and egg kind of thing, but you assume that the machine came after the clip design itself.
I'm talking to James Ward, co-founder of the Stationery Club and the Boring Conference. His blog, I Like Boring Things, has been featured in various newspapers and websites, and now he has written a book called The Perfection of the Paperclip, Curious Tales of Invention, Accidental Genius, and Stationery Obsession, published by Touchstone. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go to one of those calls. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
You're in East Rockaway. Do you do you have shops in East Rockaway that sell these things?
We hardly have any shops in East Rockaway. No, we don't. No Staples. None of that. I have a question about what I was never sure was if it was a myth or not that Post-its were invented by accident, an accidental discovery by somebody working for 3M, I guess in the adhesive department, who found these things that could stick and unstick and stuck again, and you know where it led. And I also heard that the company rewarded him more than people who were working for somebody, the company actually owns the intellectual property rights, but they rewarded him very richly. Ever hear of that one?
Mr. Ward?
Yeah, that is true. There was it was Spence Silver, who was working at 3M's adhesive division, and he was trying to develop a type of very strong glue. Got the formula slightly wrong, and instead created this sort of famously weak glue.
Which he called a solution, waiting for a problem to solve.
Yeah, it was sort of the complete opposite of how inventions or discoveries normally work. Then, after having created this at the time kind of useless glue, within 3M they have a sort of culture of innovation and they encourage people to work across different disciplines. And he gave a seminar sort of talking about the properties of this unusual glue. One of the people in who'd attended was a colleague of Spence's called Art Fry, who was in his spare time was in a choir and would use bits of paper to mark the pages in his hymn book, but the bits of paper would occasionally fall out. And so he was kind of thinking, you know, if only there was a weak glue that I could use to hold these bits of paper in place, and remembered what Spence had discovered. And then the two of them started working on finding some sort of way of using this glue, and that eventually became the Post-it note. And Spence and Art have both been inducted into the 3M Hall of Fame, I think.
It's hard to imagine office life without the Post-it now, but wasn't the invention initially a hard sell?
Yeah, I mean, if you'd never used or seen a Post-it note before and someone tried to explain what it was and said, well, basically it's a square of yellow paper with a thin line of very weak glue on one end, you wouldn't really get your head around it. And in 3M, once they'd sort of come up with this way of using this glue and had created prototypes of the Post-it, even within the company, people were sort of still resistant to it. And then they started handing out samples to all of the secretaries at 3M. And Jeff Nicholson, who was Art Fry's boss, his secretary, she was getting inundated with requests for more and more samples from the other secretaries in the company. And one time, eventually, she sort of lost her temper and snapped at Jeff Nicholson and said, you know, you have to decide, do you want me to be your secretary or your distribution manager? And he then said, because the head of marketing didn't believe that the Post-it note had any potential. And so Jeff Nicholson said to his secretary, well, any further requests that you get for new samples, send them directly to the head of marketing. And once the head of marketing's phone had been buzzing for a couple of days, as more and more people were asking for samples, he finally accepted that, I guess this product has potential.
Thank you for calling, Mark. Now, I assume a number of the things that you've written about were hard sells initially. Any others before I get to some of the ones I was curious about?
I mean, there is always sort of resistance to new products, particularly if before you start using them, you don't necessarily understand the appeal. I mean, the highlighter, for example,
from Japan.
It's well, the felt tip or the fiber tip is from Japan, but the first highlighter was Carter's in the U.S. But it's kind of difficult to explain why that's a useful product, because you kind of think, well, why do I need this special pen when I could just use a regular pen and underline something? But once you start using it, you realize how useful they are and how it's sort of almost impossible to imagine life without them.
You had to make a highlighter work. Somebody had to invent highlighter ink, which is more opaque than a magic marker and comes in fluorescent colors.
Yeah.
How did yellow wind up becoming the prominent highlighter color?
Well, yellow, that the first highlighter that Carter sold was yellow. And now, even now, I think yellow and pink together make up about 85% of all highlighter sales. I think yellow is particularly popular because it's sort of right in the middle of the spectrum of visible light, so it really leaps from the page, and it's also good for people who have red-green color blindness, so it's suitable for everyone.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more of today's Please Explain look at office supplies, or stationery, as the British call it, with James Ward, who has written a book called The Perfection of the Paperclip, Curious Tales of Invention, Accidental Genius, and Stationery Obsession. It is published by Touchstone. And we are back with James Ward, who's written The Perfection of the Paperclip, Curious Tales of Invention, Accidental Genius, and Stationery Obsession. It's published by Touchstone, and we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go now to Steph from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, your program is timely. I was kind of wondering the other day when the scissor first appeared on the scene, in what country and when, if anybody knows.
James?
I actually, in the book, I don't really go into the history of the scissors. I would need to do a bit more research. I'm not really an expert on scissors.
And I've always wondered why scissors are in the plural rather than the singular.
Well, but so are pliers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've wondered about that one, too.
Yeah, one scissor on its own is never much use, I suppose.
Well,
maybe it's a contraction for incise or incisor, like incisor, the tooth. And since it's a pair, maybe that's how it gets to be a plural.
Well, I think, James, I think there's another book here.
Yeah, I think Adventures with Scissors will be the sequel, or Running with Scissors.
I think Running with Scissors has been taken, but the Adventures might be okay. We go now to Desmond from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Great show. I love it. A use of the paperclip, which has lasted for me all my life, is used to be a surgeon, but it's, you unfold it. This is for releasing the painful blood under a fingernail, a subungual hematoma. You unfold the paperclip because it's got a flat end. A needle won't do this, but it's got a flat end. You can burn a little hole in the nail, and out comes the blood. No pain.
And so paperclips have been, in other words, surgeons have found other uses for the paperclip other than to clip their papers together.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, if you also think about how many episodes of ER involved someone getting a tracheotomy with a ballpoint pen, it seems that within your pencil case, you've got a whole medical kit.
Thank you so much for that call. Let's talk about some of the things you have written about. Thumbtacks. When and why was it invented?
Well, in the UK, we call thumbtacks drawing pins, which sort of gives a hint to their development. They're sort of used by draftsmen to hold down their drawings as they're working. There was a German watchmaker called Johann Kirsten, who is thought to have invented the thumbtack. And prior to that, people would just use sort of a straight pin to hold down their drawings. But he realized that if you put a sort of a flat head on the top of it, then it's much sort of kinder on the thumbs, and it's a lot easier to press in and remove.
But then push pins also came along. Are they a variation on the thumbtack?
Yeah, I mean, the advantage that the push pin has over the drawing pin, the push pin was invented by Edwin Moore in the US, who worked in a photographic studio and was using these pins to sort of pin up his prints as they were drying. And the push pin has that much sort of little handle, so it's much easier to push in and to remove than the thumbtack, which kind of can lie flat, and then you have to try and squeeze it out. Actually, I was in Hay Festival in Wales.
That's a Hay on Wye festival.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Talking about stationery, and someone came up to me afterwards and said that she's friends with either the grandson or the great grandson of Edwin Moore, who invented the pushpin. So I was very excited, kind of starstruck by proxy.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there are British terms for these things that are different from American terms. When I was an art student in London, the first day I leaned over to somebody sitting next to me at the next easel and said, can I borrow an eraser? And she handed me a razor blade. And I said, no, an eraser. And after about four or five times, she said, oh, you mean a rubber, which means something quite different in this country. So this is another example of these two countries separated by a common language?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of various terms or particular brands that sort of very similar products, but aren't so well known. So in the UK, if you were talking about Tipex, then everyone would know what you mean. Whereas I guess in the US, it'd be sort of whiteout or liquid paper. Mm-hmm. It's the same with in the UK, we'd say sellotape. Whereas I guess Scotch tape is sort of the more popular version over there.
And so there are. Do you know why?
In terms of, well, often it's it might be that's kind of the native version. So Scotch tape is made by 3M, which is the US company. Sellotape is a UK equivalent. So it's often that they're sort of quite similar products. And I guess once one is sort of quite well established in one country, there's no real room for a sort of alternative because they've already got that market cornered.
How was the pink pearl eraser or rubber developed? Why did it take that shape and color?
The pink sort of color comes from, I think it's fatis, which is this within the rubber itself. It's the sort of thing that gives it the property that removes the pencil. And they use, it's a sort of a very, very fine volcanic rock, which has this sort of pink color. In terms of the shape itself, that sort of beautiful, iconic shape with its soft, rounded corners, that comes about, it's the roundness of the corners comes about through the manufacturing process. They actually sort of they're cut into sharper blocks, but then are deliberately rounded. And I guess it's because sort of during transportation, if you had those kind of sharper round corners, then little bits of them might start snapping off, and so it wouldn't, but by the time it got to the shop, it wouldn't sort of look perfect. Whereas if they deliberately round them in the first place, then they're going to be a bit more resilient.
And you write that the pink pearl never really took off in the UK, but became quite popular in the United States. What are you using in the UK to do what the pink pearl does here?
There's no real sort of dominant eraser type. We in school days, I always remember having these erasers, which were sort of half and half. So there was a pink end which would rub out pencil marks, and then there was a sort of blue-gray end which was a lot coarser and was supposed to erase pen marks. But it never really worked. All it did is just, it erased the paper, actually. It sort of tore through the paper. They were never quite as successful as they suggested that they would be.
A listener, Anastasia, writes in to ask about the stapler. Does it overshadow the paperclip? I see uses for both. There are times when I don't want to have something that I have to pull apart from a stapler. There are other times when the stapler seems just so much more stable.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of sort of permanence, stapler, the stapler wins over the paperclip. I mean, what most people don't seem to realize is that with a stapler, very often you can turn the just underneath the sort of the stapler head, you know, there's that sort of metal plate with the two grooves, which then fold the legs of the staple underneath itself. Often you can turn that head around, and then there's two grooves which kind of point outwards.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you press the stapler down, the staple itself almost acts like a straight pin. So it stitches through the paper, but then it's a lot easier to remove. So if you are stapling documents that you think might at some point need to be separated, then I'd recommend just checking to see if your stapler can pin as well as staple.
Was Swingline the first staple manufacturer?
They weren't the first, but they were certainly they very much improved the loading mechanism. So what you used to have was staples would be they'd either be fed through on a sort of stiff metal strip, or and originally you'd have to load your staples individually before they even had sort of stripped together. Whereas the swing line, I mean, the name itself comes from the fact that it sort of swings open when you want to refill it, and that's sort of why it's taken off in such a massive way.
And when did we start to see staplers that completely flap open so that you can staple something to a bulletin board?
That would have been, sort of very early ones did sort of operate in that way. But, yeah, that would have been sort of 1950s, I guess, was when the swing line itself was developed. And it would have been around that time that you got these ones that are sort of multifunctional.
Is it automatic that since staplers were invented, staple removers had to be invented?
There was a couple of decades between the stapler and the staple remover. I think originally people would, well, particularly when sort of the earlier staples were sort of quite heavy duty, and so you wouldn't really separate them unless you really had to. And in those cases, people would tend to use pliers. The sort of familiar kind of crocodile teeth staple remover was a more recent invention, and that came about once staples themselves were sort of quite thin and were you'd be easy to sort of pull them out.
You mentioned earlier liquid paper, what we call whiteout. That's pretty much become obsolete, hasn't it, because we don't use typewriters anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to sort of plot their sales. I think they've probably definitely suffered from the development of the word processor.
Are there other office supplies that have gone through similar histories where they were once considered really important and now we can't imagine using them?
Well, I think, yeah, there's things like, I'm not sure if you have them in the US, treasury tags, these kind of little bits of often green string with metal tabs on the end, which you can use for filing, and hole reinforcers as well. I think they're, as now people tend to do all of their filing on a computer rather than in physical sort of ring binders, I think all of those sort of reinforcements and accessories are probably, they might not have such a bright future.
I remember the whole reinforcers as a kid, because otherwise my loose leaf book would come apart. In your book, you mentioned something called a Pilot Friction, is it? A pen that can be erased by applying heat. Why hasn't that taken off?
I don't know. I think that's quite magical, actually. It's got this special type of ink, which once it gets heated, then it turns transparent. And so the pen comes with a sort of little rubber ball on one end, and you just rub the ball over the ink. That creates friction between the rubber and the paper. The friction produces heat, and then that turns the ink transparent. But what's actually interesting is that the ink doesn't actually disappear. It goes invisible, but it's still there. So then if you then put a bit of paper, if you write something with Pilot Friction and then erase it and then put that bit of paper in the freezer, that word that you've erased will sort of magically reappear. So these sort of words that get erased, they're sort of in this flux state.
Between, it's like invisible ink.
Yeah, exactly. So they actually say on the packaging that it's not suitable for signing legal documents or any sort of contracts or anything like that.
Now, we have very little time, but Jack on Twitter asked about Sharpies. Are they a recent development? Did they come as in the aftermath of the highlighter?
Yeah, I mean, the Sharpie has sort of very much dominated the fiber tip market. They've had huge marketing spend. There was a big advertising campaign that they had in the UK with David Beckham. So you can see that they've obviously got quite a bit of confidence and quite deep pockets. So, yeah, in terms of permanent markers, they're the sort of go-to brand.
Now, we have run out of time, so we can't get to some of the other things that our listeners have been curious about, like loose-leaf paper, three-ring binders and such. But it's been a fascinating conversation, and I thank you so much for being on our show. I gather you just had your fifth annual Boring Conference. I won't bore you with questions about it, but I'm thanking you so much for talking to us about your book, The Perfection of the Paperclip, Curious Tales of Invention, Accidental Genius, and Stationary Obsession, published in this country by Touchstone. James Ward, it's been a pleasure having you on our show.
It's been lovely talking.